How can Christians and other religious believers live their faith when its principles conflict not only with new social norms, but the laws of the land? Patrick Parkinson was Dean of the Queensland University Law School. He's also an internationally recognised expert on child protection. He tries to find a way through in his new book, Unshaken Allegiance.
I don't think there's alarm, Andrew, but there is an increasingly difficult situation. And it's not about going to church on Sunday or going to the synagogue on Saturday. It's not about that. It's about how we run Christian organisations, how we navigate difficult issues in public policy. We are increasingly experiencing a more hostile legal environment than we are used to, with a lot of religious freedoms being curtailed, for example, for Christian schools and organisations.
Yeah, we've done a lot of work on the persecution of Christians in places like Syria and Iraq, Pakistan, China, Egypt. For many Christians in those countries, their life is literally at risk every day to live their faith.
You cannot possibly make any comparisons with the experience of Christians in those countries. That said, it's just a more difficult environment for many Christians than it was. And you can tell that by asking people, do you feel comfortable talking about your faith at work? Now, we're meant to bring our whole selves to work, right? But I don't think you can bring your whole self to work as a committed Christian. You may find it very difficult. You may find a lot of opposition to it. These are the sorts of pressures that people are experiencing. They're increasingly feeling they need to be silent believers, at least in the workplace. And they can be on the wrong end of lawsuits and hate speech laws and this kind of thing. It's just a more precarious situation than it was 20 years ago.
You make this interesting argument that Australia and the UK have not necessarily passed anti-religious laws, but there are other laws that are used against them. What are you talking about there? Because I find that fascinating.
Well, it's a very important point that law is increasingly being weaponized for political reasons by activists of various kinds. These laws are not aimed at Christians as such. I'll give you an example. Tasmania, you can make a complaint under the Anti-Discrimination Act if something offends you on the basis of all sorts of things, disability, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, and so on and so forth. These are not aimed at Christians, but Christians can find themselves caught in the crossfire of activist-inspired complaints, as the Catholic Archbishop of Hobart did some years ago.
And in that case, though, the complaint petered out. I mean, this is, I guess, part of the complication here. I don't know whether the complaint was described or came to be dismissed as vexatious, but it really went nowhere. It took up a lot of the Archbishop's time, but in the end, it sort of went nowhere, did it?
This is very frequently the case. The punishment is the process. It's having to engage with mediation or something of that kind. The criticism I would make is not of the complainant. They're entitled to make their complaint. My criticism is of the Anti-Discrimination Commissioner in that case, who accepted that complaint and said, yes, it could be a valid complaint under Tasmanian law. And it was simply a complaint about the Catholic Bishops' Conference booklet on why marriage should remain between people of opposite sexes.
But someone took offence. The point is someone took offence. Do people have the right not to be offended?
They really don't. And if once you start saying that people have the right not to be offended, it's a weapon to suppress debate on important issues. From a Christian point of view, you should never go out deliberately to offend somebody, to cause them upset. We should be reasonable, we should be respectful, we should be caring in all that we do and say. But we can be caught up in the crossfire.
You've had a very successful career. You were a senior academic at the University of Sydney, which is where I first met you. You then became the dean of the law faculty at the University of Queensland. If I recall correctly, Patrick, you were a consultant to the Royal Commission into Institutional Sexual Abuse, which recognised your extensive commitment on child protection. Now, I would say that you are someone I'd call a small-c conservative Christian. Have you hit turbulence personally in your career because of your faith?
Absolutely, I have. And I say a little bit about that in the book. I don't say much, but I found myself facing significant opposition at the University of Sydney, specifically because of my public faith. I applied for a senior job. There was a great campaign against me. One of the members of the appointments committee at the time said, "Patrick, we all know you're a Christian. Just don't talk about it. Nobody worries about what I do on Sunday. Nobody worries about me going to church. Nobody worries about me having a faith. But if I share that, if that's part of my public identity, if it's part of my work, that's where problems can come." So, yes, I've experienced turbulence, and a lot of other people have as well.
Mm. When you say your public Christianity, I'm assuming, though, you didn't get up and begin each law lecture with a Bible reading. So what was the public Christianity, as it were, that alarmed people, that caused you problems?
Well, I certainly didn't get up in a lecture and say that kind of thing. In fact, my whole approach to teaching has always been to encourage the students to form their own views on whatever issue there is. And I've taught family law for all these years, and there's lots of different views, moral views, social views about families. So no, I always want to encourage people to engage in their own critical thought. But it was because I was public about my faith and said that affects how I would do my job, that's where the opposition came.
What happened at the University of Queensland? Because I'm pretty sure you went through a very rigorous vetting procedure when they recruited you to be the dean of the faculty. But what happened there?
I'd written an article about same-sex marriage. I think it was published in the Sydney Morning Herald. I made an argument against the legalization of same-sex marriage. But behind the scenes, I was doing a lot to try to build a compromise solution to the problem. But because of that, there were students who complained to the vice-chancellor, as I understand it, as soon as my appointment was announced. The vice-chancellor took a very robust, vigorous approach and said, "Look, we vetted him. We knew he's a public Christian." Again, it was in my application that I do a lot of work with churches, a lot of work on religious freedom. Most of my colleagues recognized that my academic freedom was such that I was entitled to speak on issues of concern that affected my work.
I suppose this goes to the point that we were talking about earlier, though, hitting turbulence, as it were, and falling victim to anti-Christian prejudice are very different things. I mean, you give many examples, concrete examples of what you might call anti-Christian discrimination. What are they?
There are several that are very well known in Australia. The Andrew Thorburn case, a businessman, had been CEO, I think, of the National Australia Bank, gets appointed as CEO of Essendon Football Club. And within 24 hours, there's a campaign to remove him. Why? Because he's chair of a particular church board, which has conservative views. We don't even know what his own views were, only his association. He was drummed out, with pressure coming from the Premier of Victoria himself. Sometimes the law stands behind you in these things. I believe in Andrew Thorburn's case that he did reach a settlement with Essendon about that. I think the discrimination against him was very clear.
Yeah, well, in the Andrew Thorburn case, I mean, this, I guess, illustrates my point. Andrew Thorburn not only won, as I understand it, compensation himself, he got a public apology from Essendon. Essendon then had to donate a considerable amount of money to a charity of Andrew Thorburn's choosing, and I think some of the Essendon leadership ended up resigning. So the law wasn't against him. I mean, the law actually does protect religious freedom, doesn't it?
At times it does, and that's one of the points I make in the book. We face a more difficult legal situation, but sometimes the law is on our side, and sometimes we need to insist upon our legal rights in these situations.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West. I'm speaking with Patrick Parkinson, a law professor, former Dean of Law at the University of Queensland. I'm discussing his new book, Unshaken Allegiance, which looks at the tension between people of faith and often the law. Let's talk now about some of the red flags, though. And I want to raise an example that you give involving schools. And it's not actually the question of the gay teacher, because that comes up a lot. And I think you'd acknowledge there are probably thousands of gay teachers working very discreetly and harmoniously in Christian schools. What about, though, the case of a teacher who might, in her or his private time, run an OnlyFans website? OnlyFans being a place where people put not exclusively, but often pornographic content that they've produced themselves. What would happen in that circumstance?
That is an example I give in the book. Queensland introduced new reforms to its anti-discrimination laws last year, and it made sex work a protected attribute. What that means is that you can make a complaint under the anti-discrimination law. You can seek compensation if you have been discriminated on the basis of your engagement in sex work. Now, specifically, that definition in the Act would cover OnlyFans, because it covers online content of that kind. Now, imagine that a teacher, female teacher, let's say, was engaged in her private life on OnlyFans. Some of the kids at school got hold of some photographs, began circulating them throughout the student body. You can imagine that a principal of a school in that situation would be horrified, would want to take firm action. They would not be able to do so under Queensland law without breaching anti-discrimination law. And unfortunately, the Christian school wouldn't be in a much better position than the state school principal. Why? Because it's only got an exemption if the behaviour is in the course of that teacher's work. You would think that what they do in their private time at evenings or weekends is not related to their schoolwork. So this is an example of where anti-discrimination law has covered more and more of life and has given fewer and fewer exemptions to people of faith on moral issues of that kind.
Isn't the answer for faith-based schools, be they Christian, Muslim, Jewish, or any faith-based school, to simply be very discerning in whom they recruit as teachers?
Well, it absolutely is, and I give advice in the book about that issue. You want to make sure that, as far as possible, you've made wise choices in who you employ, that they are people of faith who share the values of the school. But a couple of things, Andrew. First of all, it's not always possible for Christian schools to appoint Christian staff in country areas. They're finding it increasingly hard to find qualified staff in areas like maths and science. And secondly, people change. Somebody may be a devout person of faith at the age of 25, and then 35, they hit a crisis in their lives. They abandon their faith. They may engage in behavior which is not acceptable in terms of the values of the school. These things happen.
Tell me about the case of the school chaplain in England. I think he was a chaplain at a Church of England school, mind you, and the report that was made against him.
This is one of the most extraordinary cases, and I tell the story at length in a book. I've actually met this man. He's a clergyman. He was a chaplain at an Anglican school, as you say, in Nottingham, and the school invited an outside group to conduct a training for staff and then for students on LGBTQIA plus issues. It began, according to him, the staff seminar began with chanting, "Smash heteronormativity." Bernard didn't think this was a great start. And while he listened respectfully, and there were some things in what was presented to the staff that he could agree with, others that he thought were quite neutral, there was some material that he felt was really quite troubling. And so he gave a sermon in chapel. He wrote it all out. You can Google it. You can read the text of it. And he basically said, you don't have to accept what you're being told on these things. You're entitled to make up your own mind on issues of same-sex marriage, gender identity, and so on. It was an encouragement to be respectful, but to think for yourself. As a result of this, he was accused of gross misconduct, and he was referred to the Prevent organization, which is an organization that the government runs to prevent terrorism. But all that Bernard was doing was preaching traditional Church of England doctrine, which, as far as we know, the Church of England still holds.
Yeah, but he was cleared, though, wasn't he, ultimately?
Yes, but the punishment is the process. He was cleared eventually, although he was made redundant the following year because of COVID. He was cleared eventually by everybody except the Church of England. The Bishop of Derby, who is his bishop, is still refusing to give him a license to practice as a clergyman because she says that his views promote safeguarding concerns, that there's a concern about the well-being of children and young people if he were to continue holding the views that he holds. Remember, these are views which have long been held throughout the Church of England. So this is very disturbing, Andrew, and it's the sort of problems that this book is all about.
Now, your book, Unshaken Allegiance, raises the question of whether Christians and other people of faith should defy laws that violate their consciences. Should they defy those laws?
A lot of what I say in the book is to recognize the importance of law and the rule of law, the importance of obeying the law, the importance of having governments which are effective. Nobody wants to live in a lawless society, Andrew. Nobody wants to live in a failed state. The context of what I have to say in the book is that we are urged by St. Paul to respect government, to obey the law, but there are limits to that. Now, it's not just about personal conscience. I think that's too expansive a view, because what we have seen is some Christians getting into terrible trouble because they've held a personal view, which is not widely shared in the Christian community. I give the example of the Queensland group who let a child die because they believed that the Lord would heal this girl. The Lord didn't heal her, she died. That was not a widely shared belief in the Christian community.
So, especially not with you, a noted child protection advocate, I should say.
Indeed. Mm. But there are boundaries. If the law interferes with our private spiritual lives, our capacity to practice our faith, we're not bound to obey. If it stops us preaching what we believe, in principle, we shouldn't feel bound by that law. Yeah. These are the sorts of laws you have in communist China, you have in Eastern Europe under the Soviet era, and so on. No, we don't have an obligation to obey such laws. We must be very discerning about when we disobey and how we disobey.
Yes, you've got some practical advice for people of faith and for Christians who find themselves swept into various culture wars. I gather you're not too concerned about drag queen story hour at the local library, which does excite a lot of people, excite them in opposition. Why aren't you worried about it?
It's not that I'm not worried about it, but the point I make in that chapter of the book is we've got to pick the battles we choose to fight. And we're not going to turn our secular society around by protest, Andrew. Those times are gone. In the case of the Drag Queen Story Hour, this is a very popular movement to hold storytelling times in public libraries with typically 3, 4, 5-year-old children. Now, I think most of what is said in Drag Queen Story Hour will go over those children's heads. We need to pick our battles. We're not to get into useless arguments. We're not to be fighting with everybody. We need to live godly, quiet, loving, caring lives respectfully. And that's where we need to then be careful how we behave and what we choose to argue about.
I mean, finally, you say that Christians and other faithful can limit cooperation with those who enforce unjust laws. How do you do that? And I say this as, you know, talking to someone who's a law professor who teaches, you know, obedience to the law as, or, you know, certainly as a general practice. How do you do that and still fall, even if it is only just, on the side of obeying the law while limiting cooperation?
Andrew, for a law professor or for a lawyer, this is a very easy question.
Oh,
to
it
answer.
Is? Okay.
Because if you are ever picked up by the police, the first thing they will tell you is you have the right to remain silent. You don't have to cooperate. You can say no comment to the questions that they ask. This is a very basic legal right. So it is with other laws. Our society depends on voluntary compliance with the law. The police can't be everywhere. The regulatory authorities can't be everywhere. So to a very large extent, governments depend on voluntary compliance. And in a situation where a law offends our religious freedom, violates fundamental human rights, we have no obligation either to obey such a law or to cooperate with those who are enforcing it. And we can give the no comment sort of answer that the police would expect us to give if we were interviewed.
Professor Patrick Parkinson, his book is called Unshaken Allegiance.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.